Hey, sports fans, Coach Nick here, and welcome to the B-Ball Breakdown Podcast. It's been a minute since we posted, but I want to let you all know that I'm about to start ramping up content as we get closer to the regular season. So definitely make sure your YouTube subscription is up to date, notifications on, and strap yourselves in for a lot of content coming your way. If you haven't seen the new defense I developed, definitely check it out on my YouTube channel. Tons of coaches from all over the world are going to be running it this season. And if you're a coach looking for a new way to utterly disrupt the offense, you've got to run the Chase defense. For today's episode, I welcome on the show Eric Fawcett, a team strategy and analytics consultant who first shared on Twitter clips of players in the Korean Basketball League banking in free throws on purpose. After Eric, I then bring in Tom Haberstroh, who writes the Substack The Finder and hosts a podcast with Meadowlark Media and is part of the original hashtag NBA Twitter. Tom wrote about this phenomenon on TomTheFinder.com. So, Eric, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. At what point did you discover that the people in South Korea were shooting free throws this way?
Well, I have kind of this intense FOMO about there being some concept going around somewhere else in the world that I'd be missing out on. That's something that's revolutionary and amazing. And with my work with Division I teams, I just, being on the cutting edge is something I try to pride myself on. So for me, that means often checking out different leagues around the world. I've got the ones in Europe that everyone's kind of a little bit, aware of. Everyone knows EuroLeague and ACB and all that great stuff. But, I thought, hey, maybe I should check out something different. And to me, I just kind of randomly stumbled upon the Korean League. So just kind of trying to check out some games there, see if there's anything I could bring back to the American game. And I'll say the first time I saw a player confidently bank in a free throw and there'd be no reaction from anyone on the floor or in the stands, I kind of was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I saw him bank the second one. And then I looked up and I saw, oh, that guy's an 83% free throw shooter. And then I saw a different player do it in a different game, and he was an 81% free throw shooter. And from there, I just started to look at some of the top free throw shooters in Korea and started to see that there was a lot of players using this trend.
So what number, do we have an idea just how many, like, generally are doing it?
So one thing, I'll shout out Kurt Goldsberry, who did, who looked at this and posted it in response to my tweet. But there's four of the top 9 percentage free throw shooters in Korea are doing it. I looked at two more that were just kind of outside that range, kind of in the 15 to 20 range. So I'll say, not that I've done a conclusive look, but at least 6 of the top 15 or 20 ish free throw shooters in Korea are doing it.
That's fascinating, because I had heard from years ago from some buddies in the Philippines that, like, the Koreans were doing things shooting wise, like from 3-point land, that no one else, they're shooting better than anybody else. And I never got a chance to quite do a deep dive into it, but he was like, you got to go there and find out what they're doing. So clearly they're looking at this thing right in a different ways and unlocking some stuff. So I am fascinated by that. Are there any other, things that came to your mind when you do a deep dive and watching this stuff that affect the game in different ways by trying to bank it in versus shooting it regularly?
Well, of course, the coach mind in me is thinking, what are the other, thinking, is this a viable strategy? And of course, what you want to do is put all your thought into making a free throw. I'm not really into, how do you set your transition defense? How you do anything else? I'm thinking you got to make that shot, and shooters have to shoot with confidence. But, if you miss that shot, what's going to happen with that rebound? So, of course, when you see a ball kind of careening off the backboard, as hard as it is, even when these guys are making shots, I started to think, well, is there a value in the offensive rebounding side of things? So I started to also look at the misses of these players that were banking to try to see what kind of trends there were with the offensive rebounding. And that was really interesting because, there's less long rebounds than you would think. Oh. Because I think a lot of the misses are missing far. So you can, kind of trying to describe it, that kind of action of backboard hitting front rim, then back off the backboard and spilling out, it actually turned into a lot of really close rebounds. However, if you miss left and right, those balls were careening way to kind of the short corner to the baseline. And that was something that, I'd even love to talk to some of these Korean teams, because still when they're trying to offensive rebound, miss free throws, they're still kind of flooding the middle of the lane like you maybe would with a conventional free throw shooter, where to me, a very high rate of the rebounds were going directly sideways. And it didn't look like teams were quite ready to adapt to that yet. So to be honest, even though it's a trend that's obviously happening in the Korean game, I think even, you know, I don't think they're even completely used to it yet, because there was a lot of rebounds spilling out directly to the left or right of the rim that were really available that would hit the ground, you know, two or three times before being recovered almost always by the defensive team. So yeah, there's still some conversation to be had about offensive rebounding off these misses, even in the league that the trend is happening, I believe.
Did you happen to look maybe like last year or the year before, like have they been doing this for a couple of years now?
So this is, of course, the other thing I was looking into, and a lot of people were responding to the tweet and saying like, well, were these guys, you know, were guys shooting 82% from the free throw line banking, you know, were they 82% from shooting conventionally? And a lot of these players have been doing it for as long as, you know, I looked just a year or two back. I didn't go looking for these guys' junior film, but there was one player that I thought was really interesting. I hope I'm getting this pronunciation right, but it was Yoongi Ha. Just based off the announcers and the spelling. And he started the season for the first about 3 weeks, shooting 66% from the free throw line, shooting conventionally, and his misses were almost all short and almost all to the right. It was either short or to the right, and I mean like way short, way to the right, shooting 66% from the free throw line. He was one of their important players. And he just switched after 3 weeks into the season, and he shot exclusively bank free throws. And if you look at his numbers from when he switched, he was at 78%. So this was a guy that went from 66% shooting conventionally to 78%. So that was the one player that I could see that has made a recent change. These other players have been presumably committed to the style for multiple seasons.
Well, is it 78% overall, or is it just since he switched?
Just since he switched. So he ended the season about 75% after starting 66 and transitioning to 78.
Truly amazing. And there's no question it's certainly something we should need to think about for some of the players over here in the NBA that are struggling, because, you know, the big man who I think are always afraid of shooting it too long, right? Like, that seems to me what happens, and they're so big, they're so strong, and they can't get, you know, calibrate their power. I suppose you have a lot more leeway with power using that board as long as it's straight. And that's another interesting question. Although for a big guy like that to keep it, there isn't that much more power. They're so strong as it is that they probably could keep it straight and knock it off. I have you heard of anybody yet in the NBA that's that might want to start doing this?
I don't know. I think it's a challenge. And I think we went through the kind of, you know, Rick Barry, and then when his son Canyon Barry was shooting for Florida and College of Charleston at an extremely high level, shooting underhand free throws. And I think any attempt they had to have that kind of stick in the NBA, it fell on deaf ears. And I think that when it comes to bank free throw shooting, I think so far that has been the case. So I think the question is whether or not maybe the banked free throw is going to be more palatable than the underhand free throw.
Yeah,
for sure. And I'm curious as well, like, you know, I'm the one who you know, put this video out there. And I think a lot of people assumed that meant I would be the one advocating for a lot of players to switch that way. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm not even sure where I fall on that. I just wanted to share it as an interesting trend. And of course, I think when I look, especially at like Yoongi Ha, who really improved his free throw shooting, you know, I think that maybe if I had to say, what is the, you know, what is the meaning of a video like this? What is the takeaway you should have? I'm not suggesting everyone should be banking free throws. And I did think it was interesting that even the best players are doing it, we're at 83%. And I think that, you know, you look at a lot of leagues around the world, there's a lot of people shooting better than that, shooting conventionally. So it'd be hard to make an argument that this is the best way to do it. But when I see a player going from 66 to 78%, kind of overnight, starting with there wasn't really a transition. He started shooting well, banking right away. I think maybe the takeaway is, you know, if you are a poor free throw shooter at whatever level you're at, you should be willing to try new things. And some of these players that have year over year over year over year continue to have the same struggles without making any drastic changes. I'm not saying that bank is necessarily the drastic change that they need, but maybe it is. But, you know, be willing to make changes, significant changes that might feel weird at first, even if the end, you know, especially if the end outcome is going to be something positive.
And by the way, let's just say a team gets 5% of the rebounds that are missed for free throws offensively. You know, missing this way, it might be 10%. which is still low, but it's twice as much as if you were shooting conventionally. So those 84% shooters or whatever might actually be benefiting their team even more by more possessions anyway, that could make up for, you know, not getting to 90 and being amazing at it. So I think there's really something there, and I kudos to you for noticing it and getting it out there and being the guy to draw, you know, the attention there. And we're going to look at this. I think we're going to, this will be something that we're going to look back on a couple of years from now and realize that maybe it was a big, you know, game changer for a lot of guys who struggle with free throws.
I'll be interested. And again, there's of course been coaches at multiple levels of the game, some that would surprise you, to be quite honest, and they have some interest in it. So, you know, will it be at the NBA right away with a couple guys trying hits? I would not predict that. But, you know, NAI and Division II coaches, some of them are very keen to get their, you know, 50% guys to do it. And again, coaches that are always looking for an edge, I think that there's going to be some intelligent coaches that, again, are looking at, well, if my free throw shooter is going to miss 40% of his shots anyways, but the offensive rebounding value is, you know, twice as much. Well, you know, on a points per possession situation, that could be 0.2 or 0.3 more on a free throw attempt. And that's the kind of math you can do. And I think when it comes to, you know, setting your transition defense, there's some value there with the way that these missed shots will often spill towards the corner. Well, there's an opportunity for some live ball trapping, or even a situation where you can just jam up an entry pass a little bit, or an exit pass a little bit more than if that ball just, you know, spilled out to the middle of the lane and was, you know, kind of rebounded regularly. So I think that there's a lot of potential strategy that I think that could certainly work at the Division II NAIA level, something like that. What will happen at higher levels of basketball, we'll see. But I would love to see, you know, a couple players try it out, a couple coaches try it out, and see what could happen.
Love it. Well, Eric, thanks so much for coming on and bringing this down. And I really appreciate it. And we'll keep our eye on it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, Tom, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show here and helping us get some more insight into the bank shot. I had spent some time looking through these now and have some interesting thoughts. But what was your initial thought when you first saw the tweet about these people in South Korea shooting shots off the board from the free throw line?
Tim Duncan, baby. That's immediately where my mind went as a Wake Forest Demon Deacon myself. Maybe that's why, is because I'm biased, because I went there. But Tim Duncan made, you know, a Hall of Fame career out of using that backboard. And we just haven't seen players do this ever since. And so my first thought was, man, Tim Duncan's got to be smiling somewhere. Maybe he's on an island, maybe the British Virgin Islands somewhere, just not even paying attention to anything basketball. But I'd like to think that this entered the basketball cosmos and reached Tim Duncan in some way, because I, for one, wonder why we don't bank in shots more often.
And by the way, it's appropriate as well, because he shot under 70% from the free throw line himself. Perhaps he should have tried that. Have you tried to bank a free throw in?
I haven't. I wasn't actually a very good free throw shooter in high school. I was 0-for-1. I started every game of my high school senior year, every single game, and I took one free throw. I missed it. It was a 1-and-1, and my buddies at the half court were laughing. I could hear them in the back of my mind, and all I could think about was, don't screw this up. And sure enough, I did. And I think that has a lot of lesson in NBA players too, is DeAndre Jordan, I think, has talked about the fact that when he goes to the free throw line, he thinks in his head, don't airball it. Like, don't airball it. And as we know in psychology, the last thing you want to do, if you don't want to do something, the last thing you should do is say, don't do that thing. Because if I say, don't think of a pink elephant, coach, what are you going to think of? A pink elephant, right? And so I think a lot of the psychology of this from my high school career, and for Andre Drummond or DeAndre Jordan or Steven Adams, I'm sure they're thinking of the negative of how embarrassing it's going to be if I really miss this, rather than the positive of, man, what if I just shot 60% by banking it in? Wouldn't that be great for my career and my team?
Absolutely. And we've seen radical difference, you know, attempts by players in the NBA to improve. And with Shaq had gone through all this. And by the way, the whole mental aspect you're describing, if you can't get it on that end, just watch Ghostbusters at the end, because you see what happened there with the safe off Marshmallow Man. But like it's amazing to me when I saw that and never considered it, having had every manner of ability of player in front of me to help try and shoot better. I'm actually kicking myself. I was on the court last night. I should have shot a couple just to see it, but I could get the sense that it could be harder. So there's obviously two trains of thought here. Is there less margin for error or more margin for error on this thing? And I feel like this is sort of what your idea when you started to write in your Substack about this. So how did you solve this, this question and whether or not it would be easier or not?
Well, there's this professor at NC State that has literally studied banked in free throws for years, literally studied the perfect trajectory of a jump shot or a free throw, millions of shots that they've studied at NC State. And what he found was that banked in free throws for the normal person aren't a good idea, but for really strong individuals, really big individuals that don't have any problem with the extra force that it requires to bank in a shot, it might be a good idea. And so that's why my mind went to Steven Adams, who's one of the strongest human beings on planet Earth and just so happens to play basketball. And he just so happened to shoot 36% from the free throw line is when Dr. Larry Silverberg brought this up, that stronger players should try this because they have a physical advantage that makes it easier for them to bank in a shot. That's where my mind went, is why doesn't a Shaq or a Lamar, not a LaMarcus, why doesn't a Shaq or a Steven Adams or an Andre Drummond try this? Because holding that basketball and being ever so delicate with the free throw, because it's a lot softer to get it to the rim. What if you don't have to worry about that at all and just power it off the backboard and it's more forgiving perhaps? And I think that's really fascinating, is the idea that, yeah, maybe the Damian Lillards and the Steph Currys of the world, they don't really have much use for the banked in free throw, but it's the bigs, the huge guys, the giants, who oftentimes struggle with free throws, that may be benefiting them more than the average NBA player.
For sure. I'm going to name drop here, although it's not like, you know, the most amazing name drop, but I was speaking with John Konkak, of all people, not long ago, who was a pretty good free throw shooter. And what I wanted to know from him was, as a big guy like that, was it your fear that if you try to shoot like a regular free throw, like the guards learn, that you're just going to go over the backboard with it because you're so big and so strong? And he confirmed that. So I think that is a real thing and I don't blame them. They're huge. They're 7 feet. They're whatever, all this power. Because I agree to bank it off the backboard for a normal person. You know, you're always trying to make the shot more effortless, right? So that everything flows and it's rhythmic and it's easier. So to add that degree, and when you watch some of the misses, we'll get to that in a second, actually, you kind of start to realize how there is a lot of, I went from, there must be a much bigger margin for error. You can hit that backboard harder. You just got to keep it a little straighter. But when I watched the misses of one of the players doing it, I started realizing, man, he's missing some in and outs. You know, and there's a couple inches off here or there that he doesn't quite nail it. Well, it looks pretty good, but it didn't quite do it. And it goes out, it misses. So I don't know. I think I might have switched now to think that there is less margin for error. And the professor that you're talking to, it kind of got the impression that maybe he felt that it might not be less, but it's not more margin for error. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, that it wasn't, you weren't getting a huge benefit from banking it in, but it was as effective for larger players. And as you know, like, different players have different mechanics and different mental hitches. And so it might not work for every Steven Adams out there, or might not work for every DeAndre Jordan, but it could help some of them. And that's worthy of trying. And I know that, one of my favorite follows on Twitter, Crumpled Jumper, who's Todd Whitehead, he actually tracked the offensive rebounds, or the rebounds, the available rebounds off of one of the shooters in the Korean Basketball League, and found surprisingly that the banked in free throws missed closer, like fell off the rim closer. It wasn't ricocheting out to the 3-point line as much as he thought. And on average, it bounced off the rim a lot softer, and therefore, like, the available rebounds, you didn't have to go very far to get those. And that was surprising to me. I would have thought that the more traditional free throw, just shooting it, it would be softer off the rim. But what we're finding is that in this small sample size that Todd figured out, that the banked in free throw, it's not as crazy of these bounces, and maybe that we're overestimating that.
Well, I love Todd as well. Great content. But I think what he was missing was not where, because he went nuts charting where they go. that really isn't the name of the game for me. I want to know how many offensive rebounds there actually were. So I now had to do that because someone needed to do the data. I guess
he gave you more work to do. Oh.
Yeah, I just see that's what I maybe just wanted him to do my work for me. So I've gotten one so far done. And here's the other thing that we're missing. Not every free throw is reboundable. Because if it's the first free throw, no, you know, it doesn't matter if you miss it. You're not going to get that rebound. So you can't use the entire free throw attempt number as a percentage of how many are getting offensive rebound. And there is no way, as far as I could tell, to separate the second free throws from the first without watching every single one of them charting them. So I did that for one so far for one of the guys. And, you know, he shot 17 first free throws and 15 second free throws. Only one was offensive rebounded off of a kind of bounce far away, and they got it like in the corner. But you're right. A lot of those things are they just barely missed because he hit like the very top of the square, the line, the horizontal line of the square. It like ricochets pretty hard off of the front rim, and then just kind of then all of a sudden the energy dissipates and it just falls where a defender would get it. But I'm going to do the other guys too and really do a workup and figure out if there is anything, because even if it was like, let's just say, 3% of regular shooters get them offensive rebounded, and not the ones that are intentional. Even if it's like 5%, that's still pretty significant, wouldn't you say?
Yes, yeah. And I also think that it's possible that you might see a more uniform trajectory if you tell a big man to aim for the square rather than the back of the rim or the middle of the rim or some, you know, ephemeral space in the whole circumference of the rim. You might get much better aim that way, and you might get less variance on where that ball is going to go. And I think that might actually help the offensive rebound rate, is if you can almost predict where the ball is going to go a little bit better. So yeah, maybe overall you're not seeing a huge benefit from offensive rebounds, but maybe you can kind of hack that and say, hey, you're going to miss probably right in this spot more often proportionally than if you're just doing a regular free throw. Why don't we teach almost like Alvarado just like sneaking in and getting those sneaky offensive rebounds, or Patrick Beverly's so good at that. Rondo's so good at that, is maybe getting guards to figure out, all right, I can kind of sneak my way into the paint and kind of think, all right, where is this banked in free throw more likely to go? And if you can kind of train the shooter, the big man free throw shooter, the Steven Adams of the world, to shoot them with a lot more uniformity, a lot more consistent, because they're aiming at a big square rather than the back of the rim, maybe you're going to get more predictable rebounds.
For sure. And there's also a difference between like the NBA, which you can only have two guys in. Although, again, the guys running in from the three-point line is like what you're saying could also be cued into this as well. And I'm thinking, like, I just did 1 divided by 15 for the one offensive rebound I got. That looks to me like 6.6% if I did my math right. Yeah. I got it. It's got to be higher than what it normally is in the NBA right now. It has to be. Do you have any sense of what that might be for rebounds for free throws?
I think I've looked at this before. I want to say it's almost at 10% somewhere. I think it might be 1 out of 10. I'm not. Don't quote me on that. But I do think I've looked at this. And I think it's somewhere around 10%. I could be wrong. Don't quote me on that. But it's higher than I thought. And I don't know what that says, but I think I did this because of Russell Westbrook. I might have tried to figure out like the percentage of available rebounds via the different types of shots, whether it's a three-pointer, mid-range jumper, a free throw. And I want to say it's around the 6.7, but might be as high as 10%. But again, I think what I wrote about was really just the actual free throw percentage, but I wanted to kind of get into that other place, which is there an added benefit from the rebounding? And it sounds like you're on that trail too. And I think it's a worthy question is, can you hack the rebound better on banked in free throws rather than regular free throws? And I think, you know, someone asked me this in the comment section at the Finder, is why aren't we talking about the granny shot, the underhanded shot? Like, okay, we know that the banked in free throws might be successful, but shouldn't underhanded free throws get further in line, like ahead of that than the banked in? And I'm like, man, it's try selling that to a to Steven Adams and Andre Drummond and DeAndre Jordan is doing the underhanded. Like, I think you have a much better chance at getting them to do a banked in free throw than an underhand free throw. Even though we've seen it succeed in the NBA, it's been so long, and it just, it's a harder sell.
Well, I think also, for what it's worth, as we've studied, you know, the rhythm and how we want to teach shooting better, back in the day, if you do a two motion free throw and a one motion shot, like, why would you need to master two different kind of things? And so we try and teach a free throw now in a very similar manner as we do jump shots. So then why would you, now you're going to add a whole other thing about underhand, right? Which is a total other skill set. And that's doubling up the, you know, the time perhaps to master that. So that actually, that argument, although I would be in favor of guys who can't get 50% should try anything. But maybe that would be why, another reason why, okay, the bank shot is at least the same form that you've been working on. Now the next level there is, I don't think we're going to see Steven Adams shoot a jump shot, right? Or DeAndre Jordan ever shoot a jump shot. Anyway, I don't know. I'm assuming they're practicing them, but I can't picture in my mind's eye, right, anything but a jump hook for those guys.
Do you ever coach the square, like the box on the backboard? Like, do you ever mention that in your coaching?
As a bank shot from when you're shooting a jumper?
Yeah, like, are you ever, like, talking, like, isn't it kind of weird that there's a square on the backboard and it's always been there? And is it just for aesthetic reasons, or is there a strategic reason why you put that square up there?
So it's a great question. Well, I mean, obviously, we all grew up and we knew you want to hit the top right corner on the right-hand layup, right? But here's what's interesting, we discovered, is a lot of times you're going really fast, or even if you're doing, like, a jump hook kind of thing, and you get really excited and you shoot it too hard, if you hit that right, that corner, it's going to miss. So what I teach is to hit the middle of the vertical line on that side, and you get a lot more width. So there's that leeway thing that we're talking about, right? As far as you can hit that a lot harder. And I demonstrate that all the time. So I say, when you're going in for your layups, even just aim lower on that, to the middle part of that, of the vertical line. Now, I'm old enough, unfortunately, to remember how to shoot a 15-foot bank shot on the 45 degree angle. And so I did a video last season about Russ and a little bit about how he kept trying to shoot those. And what's been lost, right? There's like information about the bank shot that no one seems to know anymore. Is the idea is that from 15, 16, 17 feet, you want to hit the ball. The ball needs to hit like on the way down. So
yes,
after it's
he has a very line drive mid-range jumper where it just feels like he's just like throwing it at the backboard rather than having the touch and the arc. Yeah.
And I found some Tim Duncans where even Tim Duncan, while it's pretty flat, does have a notion of it starts to go down and then it hits. Russ has hit the backboard on the way up on some of his shots, right? Yeah. And so it really is something he needs to stop shooting, I think, or someone needs to help him understand a little bit more about that. Although I don't know spatially if that's how hard that would be for a guy to like master at this point. So. But no one teaches like the John Wooden. John Wooden. I have the VHS tape of John Wooden in 1984 teaching that, and I would remember in my parents' bedroom watching on the VHS, and then you have to run 25 minutes to the gym and then remember what you watched, right? And then try and do it again. Thank God we have phones now where you can be on a court and watch the stuff. And do it. But it's not really a thing. Maybe we should bring it back, bring the sky hook back, bring the bank shot back. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, Sam Jones is unfortunately no longer with us, but like he was a guy that made a Hall of Fame career like Duncan, but even farther back on those shots.
Well, I think a lot of this is mental. A lot of it is psychological. And I kind of feel like, Coach, if one guy does it, you're going to see a lot more do it. Like it's almost like there's the first person who breaks through the glass is always going to get bloody. And I think if Steven Adams does this, and it succeeds, I think you're going to see a lot of copycats. Is like, hey, if Steven Adams can do it, man, like he's a cool dude. Like he's burst through that wall so that we could all do it. I mean, he crawled so we could all run, right? And I think that would be really cool, is to see, you know, the kind of copycat nature of this is having other big men try it because one person seemed to succeed with it. And then I come back to the fact that Tim Duncan did this and was one of the best players of all time, and no one really did that. And maybe that's because Tim Duncan ain't selling that many shoes. I don't know. If he has the same cool factor as, say, Steven Adams or someone else, DeAndre Jordan, that would have that sort of magnetic appeal that would inspire a lot of players to copycat.
It is interesting because, again, there's a lot of players you think about in the past, like there's not many who are associated with that. Scottie Pippen would do it, and he was also very good at that from mid-range and a little farther. But you know what I mean? Like, if you really think about, like, who is known for the bank shot, like, it's just not a lot of people anyway. Even though, again, if you were born and you're playing in the 50s and 60s and 70s, like, you would have mastered that shot. So I wonder if it's ever really been a thing that people are really willing to do. And again, how often are you at the 45, you know, in that mid-range to shoot it? Or, yep. You know, and then we could talk about, like, I'm obsessed with a one-footed three-point shot. We could talk about banking in three-point shots then, in theory, right, if you got really good at it. But I can't imagine the margin for error on that one's got to be pretty small.
Well, with seven-footers especially, I think just – I talked to Rick Pitino about this because I did a whole study on why Andre Drummond and other big men, Shaq, really struggle at the free throw line. And the theory was that big men, because they have bigger hands, the ball is like a tennis ball in their hands, and it's harder to shoot that way. I didn't find any evidence statistically that this is true at all, is that bigger hands make it harder to make free throws. If that were the case, Coach, wouldn't Kawhi Leonard have a really hard time shooting free throws, right? That's not the case. A guy with huge hands, it doesn't have any impact, and therefore the other side is true. Is like, I was looking at the guys with the smallest hands. Do they have really good free throw shooting rates? So I looked at the numbers from the combine, is hand size compared to their free throw percentages, and there was no evidence that hand size has any impact on your free throws. I think Yao Ming was another one where it was like, this guy has huge hands but has no problem hitting free throws, but then there's Shaq. So I think I'm curious your thoughts on, you know, why Steven Adams and the big men of the world have a hard time making free throws, because I've looked into the data and the hand size thing seems to be a myth.
For sure. And like Dr. J, who probably had the biggest hands of them all, was 78%. I tried this with tennis balls. I wanted to see this with the lower basket to simulate what it would be like if I were 7 feet and whatever. After a few, I had no problem being able to get consistent with that shot and with the ball going in the basket. So I agree. I don't think the hand size has anything to do with it. Now, I remember there were moments with Shaq where, like, he would be perching the ball up on his fingertips so high, and it made it look even like smaller. And I think that plays into the myth of you need to have space in between the ball and your palm, which I'm sure we all remember learning that, right? Two fingers in between here. But when you actually look at all the great shooters, I had yet to find any. There is never any space between the palm and the ball. That's a complete myth. And so I feel like those, a lot of times you get these, we're not going to name names, but you get these shooting coaches who are probably rooted in a time before they really understood what the real shooters do. And so they're giving him all of those, you know, those fake fundamental stuff that was developed over all those years. And those big guys were just really just struggle with them when it would just be a little bit more out of the box, you know, with either the bank or, you know, turning your feet more. Like DeAndre Jordan, if he would have just turned his feet more to the right, so his left hip and left elbow are more in line, I think that would have done wonders. And he started to do that 1 year, and he was making them like in the preseason. I don't know if you remember this. I remember I was at the I remember being at the training camp and watching him on the side, and he was just making him. And then he got nervous, I think, before the season started, and then just went back the way he was, square, elbow, the whole thing, and he started clanking them. So I truly believe that there's something about the lack of, you know, getting out of the box on these things to really get to, you know, something individual, which would really help those guys. And if that's what it is, if the bank shot could be it, if underhand or whatever, for sure, those things would really, really help. And I'm open to all of them. The thing about copycat really quickly was I was talking to a coach yesterday about a defense that I actually invented. And it's kind of radical because you play behind the ball. And I said, and I just did a video on it. And I have all these coaches from who I said, you know, email me, I'll come help you install it. And almost all of them are from international. No, almost nobody's from America. And he was like, of course, in America, we are all copycats. We don't want to be creative. We don't want to be looking at things. But everywhere else in the world, yeah, they're looking at basketball in a lot of different ways. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that, like, all of a sudden, you know, a place like South Korea would have these guys baking it in.
Well, like I talked to Eric about this, and I was just like, "What? Why were you watching Korean Basketball League highlights?" And he's like, "Cause that's where you find these things. You find the unconventional, the innovative, the off-the-wall radical strategies, because there isn't the shame of the history of basketball that we have here and what we're supposed to be doing and what we see on national television on First Take or inside the NBA sets where they can kind of trash players for doing things unconventionally or say like that's not real basketball." And they don't have that sort of that cultural shame that you might have here in the States. And I think that's as much to blame for free throw woes by big men as anything. I often hear it from fans, and I'm sure Coach Nick, you've gotten this a ton of time, is why don't they just practice more? How much is Shaq really practicing? And oftentimes I find that too much practice can be a problem, is that you're convincing yourself that I've got this fixed because, as we know, Dwight Howard makes 84% of his free throws or something close to that in practice. And if he keeps shooting those at 84% in practice, he might convince himself, falsely convince himself, that he's cured. But oftentimes I think practice doesn't make perfect. It just creates another habit. So oftentimes, you'll practice so much and think you're cured, but not really practicing what is creating the problem. So if it's a mental problem, if it's a psychological problem, if it's someone in the audience that you're nervous about seeing you fail, or if it's Shaqt and a Fool, being on Shaqt and a Fool, by practicing 1,000 free throws or 10,000 free throws, it's all just practice hygiene. It's all just theater. It's practice theater. It's your, hey, why don't you, Shaq, why don't you practice your free throws? Well, I am, you know, I am. I'm shooting 10,000 free throws a day, and it's still not helping me. And I think we've, in this weird, I don't know if it's American, masculine, just practice theory, is that practice makes perfect. And oftentimes I find that big men are practicing the wrong thing. They're training themselves or trying to condition themselves at the wrong thing, thinking that if I shoot 1,000 free throws, I'm going to magically be cured of my ills at the free throw line and the yips. When in fact, maybe it's trying to figure out psychologically why I can shoot 84% from the free throw line in practice, but then go to 54% in the game. What is it different about the game environment? Is it the cameras? Is it the lights? Is it the noise? Is it the heart rate? Is it the pressure from my teammates? Is it the taunting from the fans? Is it taunting from the opposing coach? Like, what are those changes in the environment that is causing that drop in your free throw percentage? Most of them, I'm guessing, Coach Nick, have nothing to do with the number of free throws you practice in a totally dissimilar environment in a practice gym.
Well, you know, I pride myself on watching a lot of games, but it's possible you've watched more than me. So maybe have you ever seen a player take like 10 free throws in a row in a game? All in a
No.
row? No, right?
No.
So that's the other thing. We need to, if you were to time the amount of real time in between someone taking like that second free throw and then the first free throw again later after they get fouled, you're probably going 20 minutes in between these free throws, and yet you're going to practice like 100 in a row. And like I said, that simulates anything. I mean, that's to more exactly to your perfect point, was that they're not even getting close to simulating what it was like. You might remember Steve Kerr had a good story with Chip England about him struggling in Cleveland shooting when he first got to the league. So what they would do is they'd shoot a few, then they'd go sit in the bench for a while and chat, and then they go back and shoot some more because that's what it was like in a game for Kerr, right? He'd be in, then he'd be on the bench, and then he'd be back in. So, and that really, really helped. So until we could kind of do that, I mean, I remember it's like, how do you create pressure-filled free throws though in a practice? That's not easy because you kind of always know, well, we're just in a practice. There's no one in the stands. So that's a huge challenge. I'm not even sure. I mean, all I know is that like the most pressure field free throws I ever took was Winter Carnival in high school, juniors against the seniors, and we had to shoot free throws to determine who was going to win that game. And everybody in the gym was there, and if you missed, we lost. And so
Yep.
I made them, by the way. But there was never more that could. I don't know if there would be more pressure on me than like in an NCAA tournament game for the in the finals. That was crazy, and that was
Well,
great
I
experience.
mean, pressure works both ways, is we always think about failure on those big moments, but we don't often think about visualizing the success. Like when you go to the free throw line, how many players, especially ones who struggle, think about the swish or think about the make and then and visualizing it and thinking about what that would feel like. feel like a lot of that negative energy is crippling them at the free throw line, is just thinking about the failure. And I remember in high school, just when we were going to end practice, when Tom, you're going to go up and make those free throws at the end of practice, you're exhausted. You want to get home. It's 9 o'clock at night. You got school the next day and you're just like, you just want to get home. You don't want to have to run sprints, but if you miss this free throw, we're going to run sprints until you make it. And so that, you know, simulates the heart rate, the fatigue, and the pressure at the end of practice, having to make those free throws. It's not a perfect game situation, but those, the pressure and the mental, the psychological stakes, I think are a lot more effective at improving your ability to convert free throws rather than just mindlessly catch, shoot for 150 times with your buddy. I don't think that is really effective training.
For sure. Now, the only problem I always had with that was you got one person shooting and everybody just standing there watching, waiting. Like, there's no way to scale that and have everybody shooting free throws under the pressure of everyone's going to run in a weird way. It's probably a way to figure that one out. But then guess what you're doing? You're kind of negative stamping that as well, right? Because you know, if you miss, everyone's going to go, ah, God damn it, and they're going to run. You know what I mean? So it is an interesting thing where
you don't necessarily make it, then you get some sort of reward. Like, maybe that's if you make it, there's no cost if you don't make it. If you miss it, there's no cost. But if you make it, I don't know, you get free Dunkin' Donuts or something like that after practice. That probably is not a good reward for an athletic performance, but you get the idea. It's like, if you make this, you get some sort of reward for the team or for whatever it is. So you start thinking about the make rather than the cost, which
I think, I think you're onto something, especially because then, you know, I the reason why I'm really against running like suicides. I don't think there's nothing about running in a straight line at a predetermined distance at a predetermined time that has anything to do with basketball. And I don't know why you want to waste your practice time doing those. And so, you know, but I used to do it all the time. The reason why I rail against a lot of the old school stuff is only because I spent over a decade doing them and like scratching my head about it all the time, thinking, why are we doing this? Well, you know, I saw Rick Pitino do it. I saw, you know, so-and-so do it. It must be right. So all those things factor in. And I think that there's also another, to get back to the mental side, there just also seems to be a reticence to adopt these things or even to accept that the mental aspect is very important. I mean, I just got into it about talking about, I talk about coaching and the communication using anger and disgust all the time and how that can, we know how the brain reacts chemically in the face of anger. And if you understood that as a coach, you would never use it in a game because you would severely affect the production of your player. And yet we still have it and they still think that it works. And worst of all, the players think they need it to do well. That's what really makes me, that kills my soul. So it's, I think, generational. There's an overall reticence to discuss the mental aspect of a lot of these things. And I think it ties right into the free throws. And again, why we are missing and what we can do to fix it. What do you think about that?
I don't think there's any coincidence that you're seeing this in the Korean Basketball League and not at the Pac-12 or whatever is existing in the Pac-12. Like, I think having these radical strategies in a league that I don't think has the same history or the same pressure, maybe different kinds of pressure. I don't know sociologically, like the difference between the fans at a KBL game versus an NBA game or an NCAA game. But I don't think it's, you know, who was it? Who's the guy at Louisville who did the underhanded free throws?
Scooterberry, or I mean Barry's
recently. No, there was an NBA, there was a big man, I forget his name, he did it, and it was like really promising that we're gonna now have a guy in the NBA who's doing underhanded free throws, but it didn't really catch on. And I think all of this is fascinating because I think, you know, like step back threes, probably 10 years ago we'd be like, why would a guy ever want to get further away from a long distance shot and think that's a good idea? And now it's everywhere. So whatever radical idea that you have, like with your defense of trailing the ball, if it helps you win games, who cares what it looks like? And that's why I think Steven Adams is a perfect candidate here. As I wrote about on the Finders, I don't think Steven Adams gives two flying kiwis about what he looks like at the free throw line, as long as it helps his team win. And that's why I think Steven Adams, we're going to make this happen. Steven Adams banking in his free throws next season. I'm rooting for it. Let's make it happen.
All right, Steven, if you're out there listening, then we're going to figure out how to help you get there, because I agree. I think if anybody was going to do it, he would do it, because he does not care what he looks like or whatever. He just wants to make the shots. And yeah, it is weird because he is so skilled and he seems to have the ability with the ball in his hand, you know, passing and things to manipulate it well. So it might be worth looking into. I know I did a crazy free throw video last year with Sochan, and how he changed his form to one-handed. And I threw in a couple other guys with really ugly forms, but I think I forgot. Did I forget to put Steven in there? I got to look at it, but I'm going to revisit that for sure. Oh, and there was someone else and I missed who was almost as bad as like Chucky. Who was the guy? Chucky Brown. No, who was the worst free throw form of all time? You know,
Chris Dudley or no?
It was somebody else. Anyway, this is my brain in the morning. Really? I don't know. You know, there was someone who was so bad. It was like Charles Barkley's, golf swing thing. Anyway,
golf swing.
But anyway, it is fascinating how you can get that far to the NBA and sort of lack. And I get the fans lament about why they're not better at it. But again, once we can accept, oh, and by the way, like guys like Karl Malone, remember he was struggled a lot of times. And what did he do? He didn't change the mechanics. He changed the mental part of it. He would whisper stuff to it in his ear, which is completely just that what you're talking about as far as avoiding the negative thoughts there. And he became, you know, decent, you know, good enough until like the NBA finals a little bit. But anyway, other than that, he was pretty good. And so that is a lot of times the solution.
I'll tell you a quick story. I knew of a NASA astronaut who was a huge fan of the Houston Rockets. And I think it was Daryl Morey who put me in touch with this guy. His name is Chris Cassidy. And he's done the longest like moonwalk in space, or not. I don't know if it's a spacewalk, the longest spacewalk by an American astronaut in the history of mankind. And this guy loved watching the Houston Rockets, huge Houston Rockets fan. And he just had a tip for the guy, Dwight Howard. I think at the time we talked about like, how would you cure his free throws? And he's like, we have astronauts who are like the smartest, most athletically gifted, like the highest achievers of human performance on planet Earth, who have the yips about certain things. Like they do this training where a simulation of catching like a ball in space and the gravity and floating and just catching it. And they can do this 100 times out of 100. And then as soon as they get in the simulator, just like Dwight Howard can shoot 84% at the practice gym, but then collapses in the games, they get the yips and they suddenly can't catch this thing. And he had this tip. For whatever reason, it is the cure-all for his astronauts when they get the yips. Wiggle your toes.
Wow.
Wiggle your toes. So he would be like, wiggle your toes when you're trying to catch it in space. And they suddenly lost all of the yips and they would just catch the ball. And there's something about the physiological or the neurological track that cuts off that yip and cuts off that hitch. And suddenly, just by virtue of transferring a lot of your attention and energy to the toes, you're curing yourself of this mental roadblock. And he was like, I would tell Andre Drummond, I would tell the Steven Adams of the world, Dwight Howard's of the world, at the free throw line, just right before you shoot your free throw, wiggle your toes. And I don't know if that's ever gotten to those guys, but I would be fascinated to learn that if you could just transfer a lot of that nervous energy and that negative energy into something like physical or mental, just like thinking about something like Karl Malone, you know, whispering something to himself, I got to imagine that that or banking it off the backboard could cure your ills.
Love it. And absolutely right, because you're focusing on you're letting your body do the mechanical action is not the right word, because I don't want it to be like robotic, but it's the without the thought, right? They've done it so many times. Your body knows how to do it. You just got to cue it into it. And if you take your mind out of the situation, you can then execute that move. I talk about that with shooting all the time. And I try and tell jokes or make weird things just before they shoot it, so that their mind is not part of it. Your body is simply doing the motion that you've been doing all this time without any kind of influence from negative thoughts or all those things that creep in. So that's, I love that, because it's also better than, in theory, Karl Malone, because it's physical versus just, you know, I guess speaking is physical too. So all those things are important for those cues.
And if it's good for NASA astronauts, it's good for me.
Absolutely. Well, I can't thank you enough, Tom, for coming on the show and breaking more of this down for us. This is an awesome conversation. I mean, not that I'm not even one of the original like NBA Twitter people. I think you are, right? You're probably hashtag. You go to Ground Zero back in the very beginning, don't you?
I think so. I don't know. There's plenty of people who were there before me, but I would say I was on the early side of things. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's just not many left, I feel like, right? After 13, 14 years, it's like an interesting slog.
I get so many of my story ideas on Twitter, and as much as I'd like to say that it is a hellscape on Twitter these days, I gotta admit, I love going on there for story ideas, and I'm so glad I did with the banked in free throw and Eric Fawcett's revelation and his video clip. Just really opened up, I think, a really cool universe of basketball theory, and I think this is just really fun to talk about. So thanks for having me.
You got it. Anytime. And don't forget, sports fans, at B-Ball Breakdown, we're not a channel, we're a conversation. You in? Are you in, Tom?
I'm in.
All right.